Hello, and welcome to the Global Film Podcast, a weekly discussion of all things cinema. I'm your host, Diego Andaluz, and today I'm happy to be joined by Ben Rolfe, senior film critic of Discussing Film.
Hey, thanks for having me on the podcast.
Kathia Woods, film critic for The Playlist, Remezcla, Film School Rejects, and more.
Thank you for having me.
And Carolyn Hines, film critic for Observer, but whythepodcast.com, and co-host of the So Here's What Happened podcast.
Hi, everyone.
So on today's episode, we are discussing Sam Levinson's Malcolm and Marie, Shaka King's Judas and the Black Messiah, and Rose Glass's newest A24 film, Saint Maud. So let's delve right into Saint Maud, which tells a story of a pious nurse who becomes dangerously obsessed with saving the soul of her dying patient, unraveling a dark secret inside her. So Ben, you have been pretty much raving about this one since you first saw it all the way back in, I believe, August or September. So what were your thoughts on this film?
Yeah, so Saint Maud is 100% my favorite film from last year. I watched it, I think, at the end of September. Because in London, the cinemas were open and press screenings were running, so got invited, and I kind of knew what I was going into. I had expectations because it premiered the year before at the London Film Festival, and I missed it there. And so I was really excited, and I was completely taken, like, completely out of nowhere. And, you know, it's 100% my favorite film of last year, and I think it's one of the best British films in a long, long time. And it's really, I think, a lot down to the filmmaking. Rose Glass does a fantastic job. It's her first feature film. I believe she's like a few years out of a postgraduate. And so really, I think all of the cast members and everyone behind the scenes make it work. There is so many memorable moments, and it's kind of, you know, the story's biblical. I'm not religious myself. However, I don't think you need to be religious to kind of get swept up in this tale, because yes, it is biblical and it's spiritual, but it's more about this sort of person who is kind of lost. And I think the way that they show Maud absolutely losing it and sort of going into this sort of trance where you kind of, it kind of toes the line between like reality and what, like you kind of question, like, is Maud seeing the truth or is she seeing what she wants to see? And, you know, for me, there is this one specific moment at the end of the film, one last cut. I think that cut is like the most memorable moment of the whole year for me. And so I think, you know, the way that it's told in this two kind of split perspectives really works. And yeah, I can't stop talking about it. It's one of my favorite films.
Well, for me, I saw the film yesterday. I had heard about it, but I didn't have the opportunity to watch it before. And I kind of like it. And while I was watching it, two words kept coming into my mind, or a short phrase, and it was psychosis or salvation. And it was about, did she really feel like she was, that she has salvation from whatever was the traumatic events that happened in the past, or was she experiencing psychosis? And as you get further into the film, you realize that it really was the psychosis rather than salvation. But I do like how the director really tackled how faith and belief and trauma can skew, can become mixed up and can become skewed. When you reach a point in your life where you are looking for direction, you're looking for any pathway to guide you to something brighter. Like, I grew up in a religious household. I'm from the Caribbean, and Christianity is a huge part of our culture and a part of our everyday life. So I did appreciate how she showed how religion can have negative effects, where if the way I saw it was like, if you really become fanatical about it, it prevents you from looking at the world outside of your own perspective, and it prevents you from understanding other people's perspective. But it also shows how people, religious people, whether you're Christian or you're or of any other denomination, people can foist and force their beliefs onto other people without looking to see what it is they need. And sometimes some people don't necessarily need religion. I grew up in organized religion, but I don't think it's necessary for everyone, because the thing is, like, in the Bible it says where two or three are gathered in his name, therefore is God's presence. But, and a lot of people take that into mean that you have to be in a physical church to get that, but you don't have to be. And I did like how Rose Glass showed all of these different sides of religion in the story. And that ending was trippy, because I was like, wait, was she really an angel? And I'm like, nah, she wasn't. Not with the way that scene went.
I mean, for me, it kind of plays into what's going on now, you know, how you wonder, how does someone become cult-like and how does someone become so consumed, obsessed with something? And I think they're all looking to belong. I'm not a huge horror person, but I like it. This was like scary in a good way. I felt like the director wasn't trying to recycle old tropes, you know what I mean? I think it kept you in suspense. And, you know, it was very engaging. You know, again, we have had a lot of horror films and we've had some good ones, but most of them have been recycled and you're like, oh, I can see this, but not with this film.
Yeah, so this was pretty much A24's first major film since, well, all the way back in First Cow, which was a VOD release. But honestly, I welcomed this return to kind of the A24 horror brand that really made them. This is Rose Glass's directorial debut, and she does a fine job directing here. The thing is, I do feel that this is maybe one of the less developed A24 brand offerings in terms of the horror side of things. It's unique in its own way, but it does feel like a parody of that specific A24 horror brand that I saw something on Twitter, someone posts, oh, well, like A24 flowchart, like, but then it had the horror section where it says, is it a horror film? Yes. Go to a cult ritual and end the film. And honestly, when that ending hit, like, that's all I could think about because it just seemed like such a parody of their past brand, even though it's like a new filmmaker. But I think the themes at least it explored were unique. I have not seen them explored to that extent before. That final frame, as Ben was saying, the film wasn't really working for me up until that final frame. And that final frame is able to kind of recontextualize the entire film. And it makes it so much better. And I think, like you guys were saying, I do feel that it does kind of work better in the context of the age of Trumpism, where it's like, she thinks that she's actually devoting herself to God. She thinks like she's an angel. And then it's not until, well, you see things here or there where you're like, yeah, I'm not sure if that's actually God. I'm not sure if that's actually a force of good. Definitely with some demonic voices here and there. And then in that final frame where you see like, okay, she's trying to ascend to heaven. And then you see, I don't know if it's more like of a demon spirit or a different type of spirit, but you can tell that it's for sure not a spirit of good. So I found that, like you guys were saying, very reminiscent of the age of Trumpism, where like these people may be looking up to Trump as if he is their God, the force of good in the world. When if you step back and you recontextualize it, you'll see that that's really not the case.
I agree. And this does very much make me think of the Trump team, especially the crazy people that stormed the Capitol.
But for me, it does, to me, I guess like when I watched it, it never occurred to me from that angle. And the reason it didn't is because, as I said, growing up with my background, I've seen people take religion way too far. And with regards to how she wasn't able, where as you mentioned, Diego, where she's not sure, where you can't tell if the voice she's hearing is literally the voice of God or a demonic spirit. And there's something called the spirit of discernment, where if you do have, and if you're in touch with God, as you would say, or just on the right path, where you're able to tell when, if it's you hear your voice talking to, and you're like, that ain't God, that's just Satan. And I'm like, and as my mom would say, you don't hold conversations with Satan. And the thing that kind of clued me into it, that she didn't have spiritual discernment, is where in the scenes where it looked like she was, as you would say, being taken by the spirit, it was very sexual. And especially in the scenes once she started working with the patient, and then closer to the end, and then where there's a part closer in the third act, where closer to the lead up of the finale, where just before she starts to levitate, the voice is speaking in Latin, but then it changed. It says two words in English, which is "mom" and "dad," and I'm like, why would it change from Latin to English for those two particular words? And the tone of the voice, whoever the voice actor was, they did a really fantastic job switching. But then also the scene where, again, I was like, maybe she was right. And we're at the end where we see the change in the person that gets killed. And I was like, yeah, but that's also the devil accusing you. The devil's telling you that you thought you were on the right path, but you weren't. You were taught, you were conversed with me. And I was like, yeah, again. But I love how the Rose Glass kind of made us doubt ourselves as we... Well, anyway, I doubt myself because I was like, okay, maybe I'm wrong, maybe I'm right, maybe I'm wrong. And then right to the very end, I like that when directors leave me guessing. And I like when I can't fully predict everything that's going to happen. Like, I saw the end coming, but the way it happened wasn't exactly the way I thought it would, especially with that self-immolation scene. I was like, yeah, that was... Like, she gave me just a quick flash of reality, and I'm like, yeah, okay.
That's interesting, because I was, you know, you mentioned the kind of sexual relationship to, you know, God, and she has these kind of, I think I would describe them as like mini strokes or something, where she kind of freaks out for a minute and she is overcome by this sort of mystifying and like physical connection to her God, whoever that is. And so I feel like this relationship she has throughout the film, I think definitely is one of the main points of intrigue for me, where you're like, is this sort of some sort of godly intervention with insider, or is she just like imagining it? Is she just, you know, freaking out in this moment because she believes that, you know, she is being touched by God or something? And, you know, so I think, you know, the whole main effect that I think I came out of the film with, especially talking about the horror, is quite arresting and definitely is very intense, but it's also quite haunting. And, you know, I think what you said about, you like to, after a film, like you kind of like to think about it, and it leaves you guessing and it keeps you kind of reminiscing on the film afterwards, I guess you could put it. I think it's really well done, and it doesn't leave your mind. And I mean, for instance, I watched the film like 4 times in the cinema, and I watched it back to back because I was like, I need to see this again. And
oh, wow.
Yeah, yeah. So I was obsessed with it, and I was like taking everyone to come see it. Like, you know, yeah, I mean, the film to me, it really, really affected me. I came out, I was like shaking, and I was like, holy shit, what did I just watch? I loved it.
I mean, I can see that appeal. Do you know what I mean? I mean, that's why I prefaced and said, I am not a horror person, but if that's your jam, like if that's what you're into, I can totally see people seeing it more than once, kind of like making it a cult classic type of thing. You know what I mean?
The other thing that I think Rose Glass did is she kind of hinted at how, especially particularly with Catholicism, where it can progress to a point where, as we would say, it's almost fanatical, and where it kind of borders on the psychosis side, is there was a practice that it probably is still being done called self-flagellation, where they would kneel on like broken glass or things or nails and stuff for their knees, and they would beat themselves with what is called cat and nine tails. And a cat and nine tails is a whip that has like 10, 20, 15 different talons, and at the end they have like hooks, and they would whip themselves with that, and that was a sign of piousness and a sign of piety, showing that they're truly asking for forgiveness and they're genuine in their feelings. And it's like torture. You're physically torturing and scarring yourself. And that's what she ends up doing. Like, you see her put the tacks in the shoes, and she's doing this. And for them, they believe that this is a test, a sign to God that they're proving their worthiness, that if they can withstand this insurmountable pain, that they're truly worthy of being receiving divine guidance. And that's what she does. And Rose hints at that, but she doesn't say, because she doesn't give it a name. So unless you really know, unless you are familiar with Catholicism and religious practices and just religious history, you wouldn't get it. But I got it, and I'm like, yeah. So this, it shows also that that she understood what was going on. Also, like, it hinted to the past. Like, we never really know Maud's past. Like, we know something traumatic probably happened with another patient, but we never know if she's the one that was harmed or if she did the harming to another patient.
I just also wanted to hear you guys' thoughts on kind of the first two acts, because I think it was a little bit, for me, uneven in terms of pacing. At least the first act, I think it took a little bit of a time to kick off, and it was definitely a slow burn, but I did feel like it could have used a little something more engaging and less passive as it ramped up till the end.
I didn't have a problem with the pacing. I thought the pacing was actually very good. Obviously, this goes against your point, but give another perspective. I thought it was really well paced, and I mean, I don't think I could have watched the film 2 times in a row literally if it wasn't well paced for me. So I think that kind of passive tone works, because then it builds up to the ending, which is like this extremely sharp and like quick end. And I think you know, the kind of juxtaposition between how it's kind of meandered throughout the film and then it suddenly sharply ends, I really like that.
I think it contributed to the build-up. Do you know what I mean? It for me, it worked. Do you know what I mean? It built up to the anticipation towards the ending. So I wasn't bothered by the pacing.
I still think that it was a little bit degrading for me. I mean, most of the time, art house horror, it's probably like my favorite genre of all time. And then this one, again, this one was still solid. Like I still gave it like an A minus, but it was missing that little something to engage me at the first parts. But again, I gotta say, if it wasn't for that ending, that final frame that recontextualizes everything, I probably wouldn't have given it such a good review. But anyways, so that seems to be it for our St. Maud segment. Now let's move on to Malcolm and Marie, which tells the story of a director and his girlfriend's relationship that is tested after they return home from his movie premiere and await critics' responses. So this has been one that has stirred up much controversy, both on social media, criticism circles. And I'm just curious to hear what you guys all think about this one from all angles, because I'm sure this is going to be a very, very interesting discussion to hear.
I mean, I feel like this is a movie about two people that love each other, but they shouldn't be together. Sometimes you're in a relationship with someone to learn how to be in a relationship with the person that you're going to end up with. They are at two different crossroads, and they approach love from two different perspectives, you know? He's very controlling. She has a little bit of codependency, understandable, but she's also looking and fighting to be heard. And I just feel as a woman, when you say how you feel in a relationship and you're being dismissed, that's a red flag, right? As far as the film criticism portion, I need people to understand, at least that's the way I'm looking at it. These are two people in the privacy of their own home, two Black people that are in the privacy of their own home, having a conversation that Black people have, or anybody who is not white and straight, so to say, in the privacy of their own home, that our art, our contributions are judged via a lens that is not our lens, not authentically us. And that's what the conversation was. It wasn't that, white critics are bad or whatever the current spin is, you know what I mean? And also, I think we cannot be these people that throw this grenade and we say all kinds of awful things sometimes about people's work. And that's all right. And that's the beauty of where we live and who we are. But I think you are very naive if you feel as though that person that you're criticizing, their art, doesn't have a right to say you're wrong or I don't agree. You know, I just said this on Twitter. I said, you can write a piece, an amazing piece, and 100 people can tell you this was an amazing piece. But we'll remember that one person that said that sucked. We'll ignore all the 100 people that said it's great. So it's human nature, you know what I mean? But I do think there is a lot going on, and you understand, for me, I understood who these people were by their fighting style. He fights to win, she fights to be heard.
For me, I know I really like, as Kathy said, people are talking about the critics aspect. To me, yeah, I'm like, about that, because I'm like, again, for me, it was mainly their relationship. The entire time I was watching that film, two things were occurring to me. My sister and I were looking at each other. We were like, what's the point of this film? And two, their relationship is so toxic and abusive. As Kathy said, they do not belong together at all. They're the way they, like, I've been in arguments where I do say like extremely hurtful things, but the things that they say and the way they do it, the venom that with which they say these things, they may love each other, but I think they hate each other more. And that relationship is so toxic. And I wish that at the end it ended with Marie driving off and leaving him either at a pile at the bottom of a cliff or just like alone. They are not any relationship to aspire to in any sense of the word. I the film overall, as I said, is okay, but I do love Zendaya's performances in certain scenes, especially the one where she comes out with a knife and she crouches and she goes into this mini monologue where she basically reclaims the narrative of her own story, which Malcolm had used in the film that the whole movie is based on. And I love that scene. That scene was amazing. I think she did an amazing job of that scene. But I find it funny that a lot of people are not focusing on that. People are like, oh, the film criticism or whatever. I'm like, yeah, no, you guys should be focusing on that. This is an extremely abusive relationship that we're seeing on screen. And the dynamics of that shit is what should be explored. I do have my own issues with regards to the whole discussion around the film with regards to Sam Levinson and the way he's talking about film criticism. But then for me, again, the film criticism part doesn't bother me because he's talking about white people. But for me, it's also about the way he focuses on like specific filmmakers like Barry Jenkins and other filmmakers. And that, again, another side issue. But the main thing for me is the extremely abusive relationship we see on screen.
Yeah, and I guess the way I saw it, obviously I don't have the same perspective as, so I'm not really going to comment on in terms of the them being black, because I'm not, and I don't feel privileged to talk about that. But in terms of the film criticism and what they were saying in it, I thought it was good, and I thought it was interesting, and everyone has the right to, you know, write whatever you want, and everyone can be criticized. So yeah, it was interesting, and I liked the dynamic between them. Obviously, it was extremely toxic, and it's a terrible relationship. You're right, they should not be together. It's not right, and it doesn't work. But I thought the way that the film sort of presented these two kind of opposing forces and them flipping back and forth was very interesting, and I was very intrigued throughout the whole film. And you know, I thought I was pretty fascinated throughout, and I think it was backed up by the cinematography, which I really liked. I thought it was quite beautifully shot on black and white, and especially some of those long takes. Like at the start, there's this one whole long take where the camera's outside, it's going back and forth, you know, just on, I think, on a dolly or something. And yeah, so I really, really liked it, even though there is a lot to dig into and maybe I need to watch it again. But the first time I watched it, I thought it was very intense, and it was very engaging for me.
Yeah, definitely after all of this discourse, I think it's going to merit a rewatch from me. But the first time I saw it, I absolutely loved it. I mean, this is coming as someone who has his toes dipped in both the film criticism and filmmaking world. So that might also be a different perspective than I'm coming at, when like most film critics who had a gripes about the actual film criticism part are very much rooted in that world and have been for a long time. So that might also be what kind of resulted in that split of opinions. But personally, I loved the film. I love, despite the fact that it's a toxic relationship, I love how they portray that. I loved how the flow of the dialogue of the cinematography was amazing as well. The performances as well, I think, Zendaya and John David Washington both delivered career best performances, but overall, I absolutely loved it. Regarding the other criticisms, I feel there is a lot to unpack there, but just at least my opinions with the whole film criticism thing, I feel that what people are taking from it is that Sam Levinson is using Malcolm as like a vessel for just him, like fully representing him. But what people don't realize is that he portrays Malcolm as a toxic gaslighter who complains too much. And again, even though he has some correct points, that's not his only side. Like he also writes about Marie and how Marie's like, wait a second there. She did give you a good review. Like some of your gripes may be real, but you shouldn't be that harsh on people, because there's definitely something good in there. And the fact that he also portrays it as a very toxic relationship shows, in my opinion, that he's not viewing himself as Malcolm. And I think that's what most people are taking from this, that he views himself as Malcolm and Marie as some other, just like some other side piece. But in reality, I feel that since, I mean, he is writing both characters, and I believe also both the actors did help consult on their characters, but he is writing for both characters. He's not on one side or the other. And I don't feel the film was one-sided in terms of seeing like what's right and what's wrong. Like they just present it in a very like absolute manner and leave the audience to kind of figure it out, which seems to have worked for most of us. But I do feel that a lot of people there were like, oh, Sam Levinson is obviously just using Malcolm as a vessel and not Marie, and that he's actually toxic and all that stuff. So that's a little bit of what I disagreed with. In terms of the whole minority aspect of it, I do feel like it was a good lens. As I was watching the film, I was debating whether or not it was actually like good for him to use black characters to portray those gripes. Because like it makes sense for like the gripes they're having, but the fact that he's just like a white man and he's behind it left me feeling a little bit iffy, until I did read that, again, as I mentioned before, Zendaya and John David Washington apparently were very, very involved in the process of writing the script, of, well, they were producing, but they were involved in the process of writing the script and making sure that their portrayals felt authentic to themselves. So also, I kind of want to hear your thoughts on that aspect of it, because I know that's also been a topic of much debate as of late. And also, I know that you guys both went to a Q&A last night.
For me personally, I will be super, super honest. After hearing what I heard, a lot of it felt like they were trying to rationalize and excuse and cover for why people are upset and why people are, especially with regards to the fact you have this white man, as you said, giving him, airing his gripes and using black people, especially a black man, as his mouthpiece to do it. And I can tell you, this is mine. I know that Katya may not agree with me or anyone else, but for what I heard and what I from what I heard and what I saw, it seemed like they themselves are trying to justify what was happening. And from what they said about how things went on set, he still ignored a lot of her suggestions. And it still is ultimately Sam Levinson's story. It is his film. And yes, they consulted. They were there, as Zendaya said, the three of them own like the rights to the film. And like they were contributing, but it ultimately is his story. This is the story he wrote first. Their consultation only came after he drafted his script. And nothing much from what I'm gathering changed with regards to the script. So again, this is a white man using black people as his mouthpiece to air certain gripes and to say certain things about not only film criticism, but things about black film. Because there's a scene that really bothers me where he talks, where Malcolm's character and essentially Sam Levinson is talking about black people using the platform they have to speak about injustices against black people. And he makes the example of a director of Malcolm working on a Lego film and inserting, as we would say, social justice issues into the film and using it as a mouthpiece. And it is said in an extremely sarcastic and degrading manner. And I thought that that was out of order and out of place and super disrespectful, because black people, black directors, black filmmakers, black writers, cinematographers, whatever, they have to use the tools they're given to speak towards the issues of black people. So if they have to use a Lego film to do it, by God, let them do it. If they have to use a Marvel film like we saw with Black Panther, let them do it. If they have to use a comedy to talk about how black people are treated in North America and around the world, let them do it. If we have to talk about it in film criticism, as like for me and Kathy, if you have to talk about racism and film criticism on film and with regards to in the industry, we're going to do it. So I did not appreciate that scene at all. And I thought it was, I just thought it was super disrespectful and dismissive of the issues that black people are facing. And the fact that you had a white man write this and then have a black man say to his black girlfriend who was telling him that he was wrong, like, it's like the whole, that entire scene was just, I'm like, y'all out of order for this. And again, this is my opinion and this is how I feel. And I do appreciate the fact that Zendaya took the initiative to say, I want to use this time in quarantine to make a project. I applaud her for that. And I would actually love to see her produce more content for herself and for y'all black women. And if she's announced in the next 6 months that she's going to form her own production company, I say go right ahead. But I honestly believe that from what I saw, she was trying to make so much excuses and she was trying to justify so much that this film is still Sam Levinson's film and what we're hearing is his voice. And for him to use black people to do it, I got problems.
I don't agree, because what she said is, I forgot now who asked her about the script. He had written 10 pages and sent them to her. And then she made notes where she was like, this I like, this I don't think works. Now, specifically to the black portion, her and John David both said they were very vocal about parts where they were like, this is not something that's authentic to us as black people. This is something you need to fix, or we need to go in this direction. I want people to stop thinking that white people are not the boogeyman in that sense, you know. He does not have the power to tell these two strong individuals how to be black. I'm not buying that. Everything that I heard out of them, this is the second time we've spoken to John David, who is very clear about who he is, where he comes from, who he advocates for. That I cannot see him sitting there and doing this film and letting this gentleman tell him how to be black and how to view the world through a black lens. I think we need to give people a little bit more credit and stop thinking that people are dumb. You know, and I'm not saying that's what Carolyn's saying, but I'm just saying that seems to be the overall discourse. And again, it ties into the fact that people don't quite understand and need to accept that Zendaya is 24 years old. She has been in this business for a long time. While she may be young in age, she is heads over heels as far as experience in show business. So she's seen some things. She has probably observed some things, and she probably has made a mental case and said, when I'm in a position of authority, this will not be happening. So I do give her that benefit of the doubt, where she said, we had input, this idea, they did want to try it. Now, I have no problem with anybody saying that the experiment didn't work, but I need people to stop inferring or assuming things without backup. And again, I think, you know, I didn't feel like there was any part of this where he was using them. Again, we need to give people credit. No one here is 6 years old. This is not a cult. These folks can speak up for themselves. Now, you may say it didn't translate well. Fair enough. But again, I honestly felt the conversation that they had about some things are conversations that my husband and I had in the privacy of our home. As two Black people, having worked in corporate America, this, that, and the third. That's a Kathy and Kevin conversation. Now, our fortunate thing is we don't have the world judging our conversation. In this particular case, how can you judge, technically, a conversation that two people have in the privacy of their own home and their perspective? And again, there, to me, he told no lies. Because we've all said the same thing. The difference is he put it in a movie.
And do you feel like people are just having a rude awakening to that? Because again, the thing is, I was really surprised by how much, well, I wouldn't say surprised, honestly, because I feel the film itself predicted that. But I'd say I'm more disappointed by seeing the type of discourse that's going on regarding this film. And it really does feel like one of those films that people started loving, then it got beaten to death with discourse, and then a year or two later, people will be like, oh, wow, this is actually a misremembered masterpiece, et cetera, which is kind of the cycle of what most films like this go through on social media. Yeah, I was a little bit disappointed to hear that that's what the discourse was focusing on. Yeah, there are so many more other aspects that I'd say are able to be discussed, or that should be discussed, that haven't been discussed in much over social media.
100%. It's lazy. And that is an arrogance in the film community. And I'm not saying all white men are like this. I want to be crystal clear on that. There is a portion of white straight men that think they need to lead the discussion and everything. They think they are an authority of everything. And they think they have to be the loudest in the room. Just because you're the loudest doesn't make you right. And again, I am utterly not surprised. But I need the participation reward kids to have a seat and grow some thick skin. You cannot, again, throw a grenade and then expect the person to just stand there and let it explode. No, an artist has a right to push back and say, that is not what I put out there. That's not the perspective. I don't agree with your assessment of my work. That is 100% okay. We have literally a young woman that's assumed to be the person that wrote it. Again, that has not been confirmed. That has not been confirmed. That's an assumption. And everybody's jumping, co-signing. We have one of our strongest critics, and I really do like this person's writing, but I'm disappointed that they chose to use their space in one of the major newspapers in this country to defend her. Like, if you read that review, it is 70% of defending her and 30% about the film. And I'm like, well, then that's not a review. Then you should have taken your article and put that over in the opinion section of the newspaper. And here's most importantly, the person that they claim is offended hasn't stood up for herself. She hasn't pushed back. She hasn't said anything. Instead, she has responded like a six-year-old and is retweeting all the negative reviews of Malcolm and Marie. I can't respect that. That's cowardice. That is immature. Somebody needs to have a chit chat with her and say, you're going to get your feelings hurt a lot worse if you don't learn to understand that this is a two-way conversation. And again, people are very happy to be clickbaity instead of being journalists, instead of bringing something fresh through the table. Who wants to read 100 versions of reviews of the same point of view, which is what we're getting? And like we said, how do you watch this film? And the number one thing that you take away is maybe a 10-minute segment, but you not talking about all the other crazy things that are going on in there? That's sad. That's sad. And it also tells me that in an indirect way, to keep it 100, they have just made Sam's point. In an indirect way, the one thing that they're trying to avoid, they played into his game, which is you chose to decide what is the proper lens instead of looking at it, digesting it, and really talking about the film. That's the crazy part. You got on your high horse and you wanted to say, well, he's sensitive or whatever, but here you are doing exactly that.
Yeah, honestly, just two things right before Ben goes. First of all, so that 10-minute scene, as you were saying, yes, Malcolm is like absolutely deriding critics, but also what people don't understand is that even Marie says like, well, like, I agree with a lot of this, but you are being a little bit too harsh. So it's not even he's full out like roasting them, like, annihilating them. It's still very much just an opinion that even Sam Levinson himself has the maturity to say like, oh, Malcolm may be going a little bit too far, even though a lot of what he says rings true. And that is a line that I feel a lot of people have ignored. But the other thing, as you were saying, I was disappointed to see as well when the first reviews dropped, I immediately combed through them. And yes, there were a couple that said, oh, I didn't like the screenplay. Oh, it felt blah, 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 blah. And if there's negative reviews that are actual negative reviews, not about the criticism, then so be it. Like, there's definitely going to be positive and negative thoughts on everything. But a good portion of these reviews focused, and like you can honestly see from this, because in Rotten Tomatoes, they normally post like little snippets of their highlight of the review. And 90% of them are just about how the film views criticism and how either they felt offended, how they felt taken aback by the fact that a film would confront them like this. And it was just very, very disappointing to see people folk. I mean, again, critics, I was expecting them to like not like it that much, most especially like a major trades, but it was still disappointing. Again, it's one of those things where it's like, I'm not surprised, I'm just disappointed. But yeah, it is kind of cool to see how he did kind of predict this this movement that's going on with all these this discourse. And I think it's definitely going to be a good time capsule to see maybe like in 5 to 10 years, maybe when we have progressed to different forms of social media or different forms of discourse, that this will serve as a time capsule. And this and the response of this film will serve as a time capsule of how film discourse has developed until this day.
So I just wanted to add in and say everything that Kafia said, I would say just well done. Like, that was a fantastic segment and I was pretty much nodding my head the whole time. So really good there. And I wanted to talk about something a bit different that I noticed people talking about online. And this is just in regards to making a film in the lockdown and with, you know, all the restrictions and everything. They had, I think, like, just over 20 crew members, I think. And so I noticed how people took out from a quote that Sam put out and said there was no script supervisor specifically. And people instantly, you know, who hadn't made films before or anything like that, people instantly sort of jumped out and be like, ah, there's no one there to control Sam's script or something like that. And when in reality, the script supervisor, all he does or she does is keep track of continuity. So I thought, you know, in terms of the discourse online, I feel like people are very one-sided with, you know, I'm not talking about everyone here, I have to clarify that. I'm talking about like a group of people are very one-sided with how, you know, they come towards this film and the filmmaking and, you know, how Sam wrote it in a relatively fast way because, you know, I'm guessing he wanted to make a film. It was a pandemic. It was bores. He started writing something and he was like, I'm going to make this. And so I think the way that people are criticizing it for these restrictions and being like, oh, you know, because he wrote it quickly, it's terrible or something like that. But I think it's very actually admirable, like how they made this film that looks really good, I think has a lot of stuff going for it. And, you know, they made it in these restrictions and it's really freaking impressive because in my opinion and a lot of other people's opinions, it's, you know, as good or if not better than a lot of the films made before the restrictions that have come out recently.
Yeah, I feel it also serves as a testament to what people can do under pressure in terms of creatively. I don't think this film would have happened if not for the pandemic. Maybe it would have happened in a different form, but not to the kind of isolated extent that it was made in. And I feel this is a trend. Again, I feel that there's two different type of pandemic films coming out. The studio cash grabs and the artist trying to make the best of their situation. And while the studio cash grabs, as we've seen with like Lockdown with Songbird, have turned out to be pretty much bland or forgettable or remembered for the wrong reasons in terms of how it treats the pandemic, these films that I feel are made by like people just trying to make art during these times, the thing is they don't take the pandemic and have it be like the main focus of their film, but they have it either as a backdrop or like in a thematic sense where they kind of discuss it a little bit, or it's there, but you may not know it isn't. Sometimes it's not even present in the film, like in Malcolm and Marie. But just the fact knowing that it was made during those times just adds a little something more to it. And you can see that there is more of a creative spark where they're kind of isolated to that household for obvious reasons. And that did birth a lot more creativity than I think it would have if maybe Sam Levinson had access to the entirety of LA for them to maybe walk through as they discuss that. And films like, again, like In the Earth, which came out from Sundance, that's another one where they had to use isolated locations. They had the pandemic as a backdrop, and it worked really, really well. And I don't think it would have worked as well if it was made during normal times. So I do feel that it is a very good testament as to what artists can make creatively during the pandemic. And then regards to the whole script supervisor controversy, I honestly, again, this is something that a point made on Twitter that was worded terribly, where he was like, oh, Malcolm and Marie is great. You just don't have a film degree. Like, I have a film degree, so I know that Malcolm and Marie is great. I think that was worded very, very badly. But he does have a point in terms of that, like, it does change a little bit for you, like, how you're going to perceive this film if you have a knowledge of filmmaking. Not to be, like, elitist or anything like that, but it's so delved into the world of film criticism and filmmaking that if you don't have, like, a good understanding of how those two industries work, like that symbiotic relationship of those two industries, then it may not fully work for you. Although that being said, my mother got a chance to watch it, and she's not much of a film buff, but she really, really loved the dialogue and the relationship dynamic of it. Again, it's a toxic relationship, of course, but just how that toxic relationship was portrayed. So I'm also curious to see how it's going to resonate with general audiences, because, I mean, it has two of the biggest stars on the planet right now. It's on the front page of the biggest streaming service in the world, and which is having more business than your movie theater nowadays. So I am going to be interested in seeing how the general public that maybe isn't at all film attuned will perceive this film.
I agree with what all three of you are saying with regards to film criticism, because I do think people like really did take certain aspects of it way too seriously and too personally. With regards to, as I said, I personally feel either I like the film is good to me. It's not like spectacular or anything, but it's still good. And the fact that I do appreciate that they did make this, and I do appreciate the fact that Zendaya decided to use the time in quarantine to like let her artistic side out and her and just be like, I want to create something. I want to spearhead this project. And the fact that it has come into something where it's on Netflix and it's creating all this discussion, I think that's really good. Anything like the discussion is still healthy as long as people are being respectful. And for me, one of my favorite aspects of the entire film is the cinematography. I think the cinematographer did a spectacular job. I have to look up the person's name, but I think they did a really spectacular job with the considering the circumstances and the space that they had to utilize to do it. I appreciate the fact that the film is set in a world where the pandemic does not exist, because like the character Malcolm, they went to a war ceremony and there's no mention of having to wear a mask or anything. So I'm assuming that the pandemic does not exist in this world, which I, as someone who has been in quarantine for months and who had COVID myself and had to self-isolate, I appreciate the fact that they didn't use the pandemic and quarantine as a prop in the film. That they showed that we can make films in this situation and not have it be a part of the storytelling. And it is possible, because I watched my Korean dramas and Chinese dramas and Asian dramas, and none of them, not one of them that I've seen that have been produced in the last year within the quarantine mentions a pandemic. It is not a part of their story. And they're like, we are setting up a world. We're going to create this world. It is fiction and we're giving people escapism. And I wish North American and Western directors will stop using the pandemic as a tool where they're not discussing the emotional impacts or anything, but they're just using it like where they're using it, as you said, to just like using it as a cash grab. To they're like, we're going to use this as a hot topic, and I'm like, nah, this is not a hot topic. This is, people are dying and getting sick every day. It needs to be treated with respect, and it needs to be treated with some consideration and decorum. And I'm not really seeing that with some of the projects that have been announced and some of the ones that have come out. So I do appreciate that they left, that they created this isolated scenario where that doesn't exist. And I'm hoping that for however long this quarantine and the pandemic lasts, that more artists do take Zendaya and John David's and Saf's approach with creating truly fictional scenarios where we can, where we are allowed to like truly escape into the world they're creating.
Finally, let's talk about Judas and the Black Messiah, which tells the story of Fred Hampton, chairman of the Illinois Black Panther Party, and his fateful betrayal by FBI informant William O'Neill. Audio clip plays. So this one premiered at Sundance recently, as well as sending out multiple award screeners prior to for critics voting. So, and again, it's gotten a very, very good reception. So I'm curious to hear what you guys thought about this one.
I liked it. When I first heard they were doing this, and then that they had Minister Fred Hampton Jr. as a consultant, I was like, I'm like, he wasn't even alive for that. But speaking to Shaka, spoke to him twice. He has a very good grasp of the material. He researched, and again, I want to be clear, because a lot of people are thinking this is going to be a Fred Hampton biopic. It's not. It's a movie about the event and the person that set him up eventually to be killed. But I did enjoy this more than I thought I would. Daniel Kaluuya is out of his mind, incredibly talented. Incredibly talented. And I hope we stop also with this discourse that British Black Americans or British people can't play Americans and blah, 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 blah. Leave that in 2020. He did that. He had the Chicago accent. Like when Chicago people are telling you he had the accent down, that lets you know that he accomplished it. Like I said, I really enjoyed this. I feel as though I hope it's a gateway for people that are not familiar with Fred Hampton's story, that are not familiar with the Black Panther Party, that it encourages you to do more research. My only little for this film is I wish they would have written a bigger part for Dominique, because women in the Black Panther Party had a bigger role. They were treated equally. They were not looked at as lesser. And I wish we had a little bit more meet into their relationship. I feel like, you know, they met, they talked, they kissed, and then, you know, she got pregnant. And I felt like Daniel said it best. Fred was very mature on the activism side and on how to empower Black people. But he was also 2021. So he has not had, he didn't have at that point a lot of experience as far as women, as far as relationships. So it would have been nice to have that balance on how he navigated that journey. You know what I mean? And again, I think what Shaka did really well, because Fred Hampton is a hero, you know, especially in Chicago, he humanized him. And I like Lakeith too. Again, my only two issues were Dominique's role should have been a little bit bigger. And I know there were some license, creative license, as far as William O'Neill. There wasn't much out there other than like the interview for the Eyes on the Prize, because those records with the FBI were off the record. So it's not like you can listen to tapes and such and such. But as a work, I was thoroughly impressed. It exceeded my expectations.
I agree with everything Kathy has said. I watched the film twice, and for me, I became more impressed with the performances the second time I saw it. Daniel Kaluuya he's amazing. He is, just the way that he, and not only just invests in the characters, but just the way like he commands screen presence is extremely impressive. I think Shaka King did an extreme, him and his casting director did an extremely amazing job casting this film, not only for the main characters, but the supporting characters too, and even the background characters, because everyone works so well together. And Lakeith was, I think he was so good. Like, his character is like, you hate him. Like, you're like, this man, and because he is a real person, you're like, this man, how could you just be surrounded by all of these people and just sell them out like this? Like, you really truly do not care. And I got that from Keith's from the character, and he did an amazing performance. And Dominique Fishback, she's a force to be reckoned with, I think. And I do wish we had gotten more of her playing Deborah in the film. We needed, as Kathy said, Black women were extremely important and visible in the Black Panther Party in that era, and I wish we had gotten more of her in the film. And one thing that I did, I during Sundance, I watched a panel that she was on, and she did the poem that she reads to Fred that was actually written by Dominique, because Shaka said he noticed that he wanted her to have more lines in the film, and he wanted her to come up with a way to have Deborah be more present in the film, and she wrote that poem, and I love that he gave her the agency to do that, not only for Deborah to play Deborah, but also for herself as an actress. He said, "I want you to be collaborative in this project, and I want you to make sure that I respect your voice and I hear your voice." And in the panel, she said she really appreciated that because it really meant a lot to her, not only as a performer but as a Black woman. And then for her to be given the space and the time to write this amazing poem that talks not only about Black struggles but also about her worry as a Black woman for this man she loves and for the child that she's bearing, I just thought that was amazing. And I really do wish that she had been given more scenes. But I like that we saw that she was involved and she was vocal and she had a say in how things went out. It kind of reminded me of One Night in Miami, where even just for a short while, at the beginning of the film, where Malcolm comes in, we see him talking to Betty, and the way Betty talks lets you know that she fully understood not only the civil rights movement, but she understood how the Nation of Islam function, not only from the perspective as a Black woman, but as a mother and as a woman married to this man who's this really big figure in the Black Panther, in the Nation of Islam and in the civil rights movement. And I really appreciate that we got to see that moment from a Black woman's perspective. And with regards to Jason Messiah, I appreciate that we got those scenes with her and she wasn't just a bystander. And this, I think Shaka King did a really, really good job. I, like Kathy said, it is not a biopic of Fred Hampton. It is this snapshot, this pivotal moment in Black history, because, and I have to say Black history because back home in Barbados, this is something that was always talked about whenever we talk about Caribbean history. We would talk about the civil rights era, and we would talk about the Black Panthers and the People's and the Rainbow Coalition. And hearing them talk about the Rainbow Coalition in the film wasn't a surprise to me because it was something I had learned about back home in Barbados. Like, my brother or my dad and his old cronies, they would talk about these things. So I'm like, oh, finally we're going to see more people discovering what the Rainbow Coalition was and what Fred Hampton did for Chicago with regards to the lunch programs and the health programs. And he did, like, Shaka King wasn't able to get into all of that specifically in the film. And what I do hope is that this film does create not only more discussion, but it gives an opportunity to have more projects discussing Fred Hampton and the Black Panther Party, and it gets into all of these aspects of it, because most people, when they think about the Black Panther Party, they think of Huey P. Newton and they think of Black men wearing the leather jackets, the berets and the guns. I'm like, nah, that was only a small aspect of the Black Panther Party. Like, they were a global organization. They had chapters in Japan, they had chapters in England, they had chapters all around in Southeast Asia, they had chapters all around the world. And I just hope that this film does lead to more discussion and it leads to people getting more projects greenlit, like maybe a mini docuseries on Netflix or Amazon Prime or something, where more people become educated, kind of like the Small Axe films by Steve McQueen, because what the Mangrove does talk about the Black Panther chapter in London at that time, and that was led by what's her name? I'm drawing a blank on her name now. Why, Letitia Wright's character, like, that was a real woman, and that was a real, and those were all real events.
You guys bring up some really good points, and I completely agree. And I just wanted to talk about something different. And so we talked about how good Daniel Kaluuya is. He is so good, and I mean, I'm part of the Critics' Choice and I voted for him in supporting actor. I think he delivers one of the best performances of the year. But I also, and I know he's on the other side, he's an informant and everything, and you know, he's more morally ambiguous because he does assist the FBI and everything. But I think for me, Lakeith Stanfield's performance was completely jaw-dropping because I feel like you can physically feel his inner struggle. And at the same time, like, he's doing things that, you know, we pretty much disagree with because we all align with the Black Panthers and everything. But, you know, seeing Lakeith Stanfield's performance, it really kind of struck me because his soul is kind of shaking with internal struggle, and you can see it, like, physically. I feel like, you know, throughout the film, his appearance just kind of gets withered and withered as it goes on. And, you know, so I really appreciated, you know, both Dominique's performance and Daniel's performance, but also Lakeith's. I thought he was really, really good in his role. And another point that I really loved about the filmmaking, because I think this is one of the best made films that we got last year. And, you know, it's cinematography for me. So I'm a cinematographer myself, and I feel like, you know, a lot of films where I find, you know, my immersion is in the cinematography. And for me, this film, you know, the way it's shot, its colors, its stylizations, especially with that opening scene where he sort of comes out the car and it's kind of slow, and then the light with the reflections and everything. Anyway, so I thought it was made in a really bold and kind of stylistic way that really called out to me. And yeah, but overall, the film is very unflinching and it's heartbreaking, absolutely heartbreaking. You know, that one moment that Dominique has, you know, basically, you know, the big sort of climax of the film happens and, you know, a tragedy occurs, and Dominique's reaction to what is happening, and, you know, the camera holds on her and her reaction, and you're just kind of left there shocked. And so I think, you know, Chucky King did a really, really good job at doing what he wanted to do, portraying these two sides. You viscerally hate the FBI and everything because they're just absolute monsters. And yeah, I really, really liked it. I thought it was a really well-made film that I won't forget for a long time.
Yeah, honestly, I feel this is one of the most important films of the year. It's such a strikingly powerful and timely masterwork. I think everyone here is firing on all cylinders. But one thing is that I feel that in the American school system that I grew up in, we are taught, just like Malcolm X, that, like, okay, Malcolm X and the Black Panthers, they were fighting for racial justice, but they were doing it in a very violent and unhinged way. And so, again, coming into this film, like, I knew there was more to it, but that was pretty much the only thing I heard about it. But then again, like, once the trailers came out, I did some research, and of course I found that that was not the case at all, and that it was, in fact, how they were painted by the FBI. So I was a little disappointed. I mean, I guess that's how things are in the school system nowadays, but that was my experience with learning about that prior to the film. But going into the film, it was an incredibly informative experience. And also, there were things like the Rainbow Coalition, the fact that he was able to look past race to actually find, because again, obviously it was a race issue, but he was actually able to look past race, for instance, like even reaching out to white rednecks and said, like, look, you guys are also in this because this is not only about race, it's also about the balance of power. And again, poor white people are also at a very, very economically disadvantaged point compared to the people who are running the country as well. And also, I'm really blanking on the name of this event. I think it was Shay's Rebellion, but I'm not quite sure. But back in colonial times, there was this rebellion going on. The poor people of all races were banding together to try and overthrow people in power in the colonies. And then the people in power were like, hey, like, to the white people, hey, we have more in common than you guys do with the black people. And seeing kind of that play out a little bit more in this film was impressive to me. And again, it was just the way it manages its themes as well, because I know this is going to draw a lot of comparisons, especially during Oscar season, Trial of Chicago 7. And while I think they do touch on the same themes, Trial of Chicago 7 is much lighter and much feel-good, and it definitely captures a sense of optimism that I don't feel is particularly right for these times, and I feel that's maybe where a lot of the criticism for that film is coming from. But this one ends on such a dark note. But the thing is, it's so dark and so right for these times that it's just incredibly powerful. And those last 10 to 15 minutes, I honestly, again, I didn't know much about what ended up happening with Fred Hampton, what ended up happening with William O'Neill, but it was just incredibly devastating and depressing to see that happen. And these are things that, like, you may think at first, oh, this was all the way back, but no, similar things happened with even Breonna Taylor last year, where people are killed in their sleep, and I don't know, it's just, it's a good way to reflect what's going on in our times while looking back into a kind of like a semi-period piece. I feel it does it much better than Trial of Chicago 7. And it's just overall an incredible film. I don't think, maybe a little bit with the pacing towards the middle of the second act, there are parts here and there that drag a bit, or I think it gets a little bit lost. But overall, it's just an incredible film that, again, it's one of the most important films of the year.
Something else that I appreciated about the film was that he made a conscientious decision to show his, not to show his death. I mean, because in real life, it was very horrific. And he was shot between 90 and 94 times. And the mattress was soaked with his blood. So I'm glad that Shaka made the decision not to portray that. Yeah, we heard it, and I think it had a more lasting effect by us hearing it instead of you seeing it. It made you kind of understand, like, what really happened here. And I agree with you, Diego, that it makes you think, you know, it is 2021, especially what happened last summer. Have we really learned? You know what I mean? Has the discourse between community and the police gotten better? No, I mean, that's the sad part.
Yeah, I agree. Well, first, I just want to touch back on what was said about the cinematography. I do, like, Ben, I do that for opening shot. I think was one of my favorite shots in the entire film. Like, I love how he goes around and he swings the camera around Lakeith, and it goes from inside out, then back, and it goes inside. I thought it was a brilliantly choreographed sequence. Yeah, this film is extremely important for also many reasons. And I would say this film should be done as a triple feature with MLK, FBI with Sam Pollard, and Mangrove by Steve McQueen. Actually, you know what? Make it a quadruple feature. Add Billie Holiday versus the United States of America, where it shows how power structures, especially the FBI in particular, targeted Black figures in America, and they hounded them and they harassed them and they mentally tortured them because, like, they wrote letters to Martin Luther King Jr. telling him to commit suicide. They were mentally torturing that man. And with regards to Mangrove, it's set in England, but it shows how the judicial system and the police organization were protecting the cops and not the citizens, and how the judicial system was always working against Black people, because until the Mangrove trial, no Black person had ever won a case against the police in England. So that was a landmark case in judicial, especially I would say with regards to European judicial history. And these four films show how, like, political structures and power structures are used to oppress Black people. And it shows how, and they need to be seen. And we need more films like this to show that Black people are making this up when we say that systematic racism and oppression is alive and well, and it still functions. Don't believe that the FBI is not doing the same thing now. When you have things like the Black Lives Matter movement, and you have people that were at protests, and organizers that were at protests were being found because the FBI and other investigative organizations were searching for them online and using people's Twitter feeds and people's tweets and social and TikTok posts and whatever to look for these people and find them. And, like, these are things that are still happening, and it is important that we understand the history and we understand how Black people are consistently targeted. And I want more projects like this. And it's not about Black trauma, it's about Black history and about understanding that these things are not made up. And I agree with Kathy, where I like that Shaka King did not show Fred being actively shot. The gunshots were enough. Like, for instance, like, for me, where I started to actually start to cry is when that agent put a gun against Deborah's stomach, and she's pregnant with Fred Hampton Jr. And that scene is where I cried. I'm like, what kind of monster could you be to put a gun, a loaded gun, against a pregnant woman's stomach, threatening not only her life, but directly threatening the life of her child? Then you just hear her, you see her standing at the door with her back, so you turn and you just hear the gunshots go off. I'm like, that was super hard for me. And I like that the violence was not gratuitous, because I cannot guarantee that if another head director had done this, whether black or non-black, would have treated it the same way.
And I feel that one of the most powerful moments I think of the film that really drove the point home was actually towards the end, which it's not a spoiler because this is just history, but the FBI is kind of at their door. And again, with the portrayal of the Black Panthers and again, like what many people have been taught, what has been kind of like used in propaganda, is that the Black Panthers, they would just use violence all the time to resolve anything. But in this sequence, I think you see kind of the true heart of them, because they're faced with, they know that the FBI is at their door. They know that they probably have their guns ready, but they decide to trust in the good of the FBI and not like immediately shoot back. Like they're cautious, but they try to not immediately shoot back. And they're cautious. But the second it happens, the FBI just absolutely just demolishes them. They just like just keep on shooting. And they aren't. And the Black Panthers did not shoot first. They're just shooting in response, in self-defense. Because in reality, they just have a couple of guns. But the FBI is an entire government-sourced organization that has just basically cornered them. I don't know, that ending was, again, one of the most powerful ones I've seen. So any other thoughts on Judas and the Black Messiah?
Watch it. That's it. Watch it.
Yep. Same.
Yeah. I definitely agree. Like, this will be coming to HBO Max and theaters on February 12th. So no excuses. If you're either an Oscar junkie looking for more informative films, looking for just a great film, definitely check this one out, because you will not want to miss it. It's one of the most, I think, timely and most important and informative films of the year. And I really hope it also helps change people's perception of the Black Panther movement as well. Well, that's it for this week's episode of the Global Film Podcast. Where can we find everyone on social media? Ben?
You can find me at the DC TV Show on Twitter.
Carolyn?
You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at CarrieCNH12, so that's CarrieCNH12. You can find my writing on Observer, The Beat, But Why the Podcast, and a bunch of other sites, as well as follow my live tweet events for Saturday Night Sci-Fi every Saturday at 10 p.m. Eastern, and Dramas with Carrie for my Asian drama live tweet.
And Kathia?
You can find me at Kathia_Woods, KathiaWoods on Twitter.
And you can find me at the Diego Andaluz, and that's Andaluz, on both Twitter, Letterboxd, and Instagram, as well as the podcast at Global Film Pod on Twitter. So thank you all so much for coming on board, and make sure to rate, subscribe, and follow us to be notified when the next episode comes out. Next week, we will be discussing I Care A Lot, Nomadland, and Minari in another Global Film Critic Roundtable.